Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. Joel Coopersmith, Chief Research and Development Officer at the Veterans Health Administration. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare tells us about a breathalyzer that uses nanotechnology to sense the presence of diabetes and even lung cancer. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Smoking remains one of the world's leading causes of preventable death, and yet quitting is still a challenge for so many smokers. Pregnant women who smoke pose a greater health risk to their growing babies, increasing the likelihood for preterm birth and other lifelong health consequences, and that's to say nothing of the health danger for infants exposed to secondhand smoke. A recent study published in the Journal of Women's Health highlights another promising intervention, municipal smoking bans. Municipal smoking bans are a relatively recent phenomenon, so there's been very little study of their impact on maternal smoking cessation and infant health until now. In 2003, Pueblo, Colorado initiated a citywide smoking ban that was strictly enforced. Researchers compared Pueblo to El Paso, Colorado, which had similar population demographics but no municipal smoking ban. During a two-year period, they compared maternal smoking rates in each city and infant health statistics as well. And what they found was pretty astonishing. 38% fewer pregnant women in Pueblo smoked, and there were 23% fewer preterm births compared to the maternal and infant population in El Paso. They say the smoking ban had a direct, improving impact on maternal and infant health in a short period of time. The report suggests that the evidence should be fodder for communities around the nation to consider following suit. A strongly enforced municipal ban on smoking, leading to significant improvements in maternal and infant health outcomes, not to mention for the entire community, now that's a bright idea.
We're speaking today with Dr. Joel Coopersmith, Chief Research and Development Officer of the Veterans Health Administration, which is the largest integrated healthcare system in the United States. Dr. Coopersmith is the former Dean of Biomedical Science at Medical School of Texas Tech, during which time he greatly expanded research initiatives there. He is a scholar in resident at the Institute of Medicine and has more than 160 publications, including two books to his credit. Dr. Coopersmith, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
I'm happy to be here.
You know, as a veteran, and you served in the Vietnam War, you have a unique understanding of the veterans' experience. And it goes without saying that many of the conditions your team is researching stand to have a direct impact in the lives of vets, many of whom have ongoing conditions as a result of their service. Now, the VA is conducting a number of research initiatives on everything from building better robotic prostheses to improving treatment for brain injury. Tell us about some of the success stories that have led to improvements in treatment in patients' health.
Well, we've had a long history, actually. We've had an 87-year history. As of this year, we've been here for 47 years. Our program started in 1925, but was greatly expanded after World War II, and then again in recent years. And we've had many successes over the years, in not only in post-deployment conditions, but in others. The first cardiac pacemaker was implanted in the VA. The first liver transplant was done in the VA. First software for CAT scanning was done in the VA. Three Nobel Prizes. Much of the early work in high blood pressure was done in the VA, including the clinical trial that proved that treating high blood pressure actually works to prolong lives and prevent disability. In more direct post-deployment conditions, we've done a lot of work in PTSD and in traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. The only really extensive treatment for it was proven in the VA, prolonged exposure therapy, which we've implemented. More recently, we found that a drug helps nightmares that people get in PTSD. We proved that. And also a lot of research to improve general outlook by athletic endeavors and that sort of thing. So we've done a lot of work over the years.
Well, Dr. Coopersmith, first, don't think people often know, all that the VA has accomplished and the way in which things developed there have benefited the entire population. So thank you for that. And one of the areas that we have long admired the VA for is the way you've led the way in promoting the integration of behavioral health with medicine and with primary care. And perhaps nowhere is there more of a need for team-based approaches to care than in the population of our returning soldiers, many of whom have such complex mental health as well as medical issues. What is your research in this area telling you about best modes for delivering quality integrated care to meet those complicated needs? And maybe you can expand that to lessons that primary care in general can take away from the experience within the VA.
Well, that is really a very good point and really how we operate. I think the VA has been the leader in that area. I do want to say that one thing you said is it's not well known. Our research program is not very well known, and it has, over the years done a lot. But I think the best example of that is care for depression. Depression is an important condition, obviously, in our society, but it particularly affects individuals post-deployment. First, we did research and showed that a collaborative care program between primary care physicians and mental health professionals, particularly psychiatrists, psychologists, was highly beneficial and an efficient way to treat it. And once we proved that was true, we tested it throughout our system in a way that it's unique for the VA being a large research establishment that's embedded in a healthcare system. So we could test this in our healthcare system, and we started off in one VA. We moved then to 5 or 6 VAs in various locations and to 20 or 30 and then finally everywhere to show that this care could be delivered, to sort of work out what the bugs might be in delivering it and, make the interactions between these professionals, between the primary care physician and the mental health physician or psychologist.
Dr. Cooper-Smith, you listed a whole litany of remarkable achievements by the VA, but also I'm not sure the public knows that the VA has been an early adopter of electronic medical records now for some time, and fair to say that it's greatly enhanced the organization's ability to collect and mine data. What's the VA experience, or what have you learned about the implementation of electronic medical records with such a large patient population, and how can that be used to improve research and quality of patient care? And maybe you can also help the rest of the nation practices who are now slowly transitioning to the use of medical records. What can they learn from your experience at the VA?
I think many things. Firstly, it has been here for a while. It goes back to, and this is what another feature of the VA, it's individual research physicians, you might say, playing with software, working with software, and developing software that could be used in electronic health record, which then was coalesced into a system-wide approach, which was adopted about 15 years ago. And we do have probably the longest continuous experience with electronic health records. It is essential to our research in many ways, to our genetics program, to everything that we plan to do in clinical research really involves the electronic health record. We look at, try to look at patients who, suicide has been a problem, and obviously, and we're looking at how we can improve the predictability of it, so we can look back at through electronic health records just to see what visits there were by the individual who may have either committed suicide or tried to commit suicide before that, and see what then might have been done. I also want to mention one other thing that I think we're doing now for the future in research, and it's called point-of-care research, and that is usually when you do a clinical trial, a randomized controlled trial, which is the most scientific way of evaluating new treatments and so forth, you sort of pull the patient out into a sort of separate universe of this trial with separate physicians, and very particular patients are often picked, and separate ways of approaching the patient. Well, instead of doing it that way, for many things that we can study, we're doing this within the healthcare system, and we're doing it now with actually also in diabetes, delivering insulin therapy after surgery. Instead of sort of pulling the patient out into another sort of treatment mode, the physician who is seeing the patient still sees the patient, still delivers the care, and all of it is recorded in the electronic health record. So the electronic health record serves as the data, and this enables us to do studies, and this is something that people have been trying to do for a long time in research, do studies in a realistic healthcare environment. So it makes us our studies really much more valuable, I think, and much easier then to translate into care when whatever therapy is proven to be better is shown in these studies.
Well, that's very interesting, and I suspect perhaps intended or unintended consequences really increasing the satisfaction and the reward of practicing as a primary care provider or member of the team in that setting to be involved in the research.
Absolutely. That is a very characteristic of the VA also. And primary care research is very important to us, and physicians do get a sense of satisfaction of doing it.
Dr. Cooper-Smith, this may actually be what you were referring to, or perhaps it's separate. Another innovative program launched by the VA that we're tracking is the QERI program, the Quality Enhancement Research Initiative, which encourages research that has a direct impact on the quality of the care that's delivered within the VA system. Could you describe that QERI program for us? Is that what you were referring to, or is that something different?
It was the Quality Enhancement Research Initiative that did apply it to the healthcare system. Now, what it is, again, because we are a research program embedded in a healthcare system, we have a natural door toward translating the research directly to the veteran. So what has been organized is a group of initiatives, actually, in this Quality Enhancement Research Initiative, and mostly disease or organ system-oriented. We have one in congestive heart failure and diabetes, HIV, hepatitis, polytrauma, mental health, stroke, spinal cord injury. So the depression program is an example. But another example would be in diabetes, which I also started to mention, is translating the new guidelines and the results of these large studies that have shown that you need to individualize care. Post-traumatic stress disorder, we are translating the prolonged exposure therapy, which was proven to work. In congestive heart failure, they've done one example of what they've done is improve the transition of care in a hospital to care at home. In HIV, we've expanded testing. So there are many other things that have been done. There's also another one that's an e-health initiative, and that's working with various aspects of our electronic health record.
We're speaking today with Dr. Joel Cooper-Smith, Chief Research and Development Officer at the Veterans Health Administration, which is the largest integrated healthcare system in the United States, serving over 8 million veterans. Dr. Cooper-Smith, in addition to running your own programs at the VA, you've been selected to serve on the Federal Coordinating Council for Comparative Effectiveness Research, which was set up with monies from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, also known as the Stimulus Bill, to conduct research comparing the strengths and weaknesses of various medical interventions. Now, the Obama administration is seeking to improve transparency in healthcare, and your work with the council aims to give clinicians and patients valid information that will, I guess, hopefully lead to improved performances in the United States healthcare system. Can you talk to us a little more about this project, and how does it relate to the overall work that you're doing at the VA?
It's a very, actually, nice marriage of what the VA is doing and now others are doing. And I, first of all, just about the VA. The VA has been doing this kind of research for 35 years or so. Some of the early work in cardiac surgery and various other aspects of heart disease, that some of the early research that the VA did in those years was really comparative effectiveness research. Mm-hmm. And it is a large program in it now. And what the council did was looking at is it had a certain amount of money from the stimulus bill, how to use that effectively in comparative effectiveness research. And what the council decided was to use it to build infrastructure for the ability to do comparative effectiveness research. But the VA has been a very large part of this, part of comparative effectiveness research. And a much higher proportion of comparative effectiveness research papers are published by the VA. We were also interested in the council in new ways of doing research, new methodologies, and I think those are beginning to be adopted. Actually, the point of care research is one of those attempting to do this within the healthcare system is an approach for comparative effectiveness research, again, to find a realistic environment to do the research in, a more natural environment, and I think it fits for comparative effectiveness research very well.
Dr. Cooper-Smith, you say that one key to the success of the research being conducted at the Veterans Health Administration is collaboration. And rather than being isolated or insular, you've reached out and enlisted veterans groups around the country, enlisted other research institutions and other groups to join with you in your research efforts. Tell us more about these collaborators, maybe particularly the veterans groups, and how you've worked to enlist and coordinate and maintain the participation of so many diverse elements.
Let me first say that our collaboration with the universities has been fundamental to VA research. Almost all of our researchers have medical school appointments, and VA research is crucial to the research programs of a number of medical schools, University of Michigan, Yale, Stanford, many others around the country. And we really work in teams, so that's a very important collaboration to us. And now, as far as the veteran service organizations, these are also very important collaborators in many, many ways. They have been very helpful. And just to give you a few examples, I'll give you one example of a program in Milwaukee, actually, that was a program of peer-to-peer help in treating your blood pressure and in losing weight. And I think it was 8 veteran service organizations, the American Legion, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the disabled American veterans, were participants in this. And what they found, actually, is there was a modest effect on blood pressure, but there was a lot of effect on weight. So that was a result of that. And they called it the Power Program. Another place is in our genomics program and our Million Veteran Program. We worked very closely with the veteran service organizations from the beginning. We did a survey of veterans, how we could recruit veterans better. They helped us in that recruitment. And that's another example of where we've worked very closely.
Can you pull the thread a little more on that Million Veterans Program, the MVP program? It sounds like an enormous undertaking. And sort of walk us through how you envision the Million Veterans Program working. What will the potential outcomes be?
The Million Veteran Program is a program to collect genes on 1 million veterans and link it to the electronic health record. What we're doing is we send veterans a letter. It's now in 40 medical centers around the country as of last October. A total of 40 medical centers are involved around the country. And we send veterans a letter. They can opt into this program or opt out. If they opt in, we arrange at their next scheduled appointment at the VA to collect a blood specimen for genetic analysis and other analysis, and they agree to allow us to examine their records in the future for possible studies. And then so it's a database, and then for those studies, we will have to get repeated consents and so forth. As of now, over 110,000 individuals have agreed to this.
Very impressive.
And over 50,000 have gone through everything, the whole, all the blood drawing and mm-hmm. surveys and so forth. And I think an important point of that is, and shows something about veterans and about VA research, is that 20% of them have come on their own, have heard about this study mm-hmm. or seen something about it, and have gone to a VA and volunteered. They know that there may or may not be benefit for them. They know, but they also know that they will be helping other veterans as well as other individuals. Some of the early studies we'll be doing on serious mental illness and on post-traumatic stress disorder and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis are some of the earlier areas of research. Gulf War disease is another one. The reason we think that in the future this will really change the way medicine is practiced is one thing we can do, obviously, if we have the genes, we can maybe predict susceptibilities to diseases. But I think even more importantly, when we learn about the genes, which is the hard wiring essentially, and then how those genes affect the body, what is the biochemistry of the body, proteomics, metabolomics, how these genes work, we can then learn how we might be able to treat these diseases better. And actually, we've already started that. In schizophrenia, we have a drug that helps schizophrenia in really a much better way than has ever been done before. So that's one of the things we can do. The other thing, again, because the research is within the healthcare system, we can actually determine what the practical value of some of these genetic tests will be, what the practicality of that knowledge will be to the doctor or provider seeing the patient, and how useful it will be and how efficient it will be in use. And I think those things are something, again, that the VA can do because we have a healthcare system, because we have programs like the Query program and others.
Dr. Cooper-Smith, you've spoken to so many innovations already, but we like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and around the world, what do you see in terms of innovation that our listeners at Conversations should be keeping an eye on?
Well, I'll give you something that's hot off the press. In fact, it was just published in Nature, and it's the brain-computer interface. And this is an approach for patients with paralyzed limbs or who have prostheses. And it's first through an implanted electrode, individuals were able to, through their thoughts, move a prosthetic limb. And actually move to some more refined moments, emotions, grabbing a ball and moving it. This was just published in Nature by a team of VA researchers, also collaborating with Brown University and Harvard and MIT, and but done at the VA. I think this is something for the future. I mean, it can even, in the future, through thoughts, move wheelchairs. So that's something that's the one I would point to.
Well, our nation should be very proud of the work of the VA. We've been speaking today with Dr. Joel Cooper-Smith, Chief Research and Development Officer at the Veterans Health Administration. Dr. Cooper-Smith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report. When you hear the word breathalyzer, you think drunk driving detector, right? Well, that's how it's been known in the past. But scientists at Stony Brook University on Long Island, New York, have taken that simple concept of exhaling into a tube to detect high levels of alcohol into something that could have an amazing impact on early detection of diseases. Dr. Parina Guma has been working for 10 years to refine sensors in a standard breathalyzer machine using the latest 21st century nanotechnology to be able to detect the presence of diseases as complex as lung cancer. Dr. Guma says her single-breath disease diagnostic breathalyzer programs microscopic nanosensors to detect precise chemical biomarkers that indicate the presence of a specific disease.
You have a nanosensor, a nanomaterial, a nanoceramic that can now detect one specific chemical in the sea of human exhale. And there are really thousands of chemicals in our breath.
The nano wires of spun titanium can detect the presence of minute amounts of biomarker molecules detecting things like diabetes, kidney disease, breast cancer, or lung cancer with one single exhalation. Dr. Guma's team of scientists and engineers have developed a sensor chip coated with minuscule nanowires several thousands of a width smaller than a human hair that can pick up those single disease markers in the human breath.
We have been able to capture these particular biomarkers, these few chemicals that signal disease, and do that in a similar way, which is just a single exhale.
She says while the world of genomics is very exciting, nanotechnology is making it more possible than ever to do instant diagnosis.
Now we can really get these individual contributions, individual molecules, and get these fast diagnostics and inexpensive and personalized ones. And it might have immediate effect to improving human health.
Dr. Guma says this kind of device wouldn't have been possible without recent developments in nanotechnology manufacturing. The single-breath diagnostic breathalyzer is in prototype testing, and human tests are scaling up soon. And this could be a powerful new weapon in identifying and attacking diseases early for the best possible outcomes. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is a Connecting Our Communities initiative from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.